I'm Christopher Lydon with the suddenly sought-after explainer of unlikely events, Nassim Nicholas Taleb. Think 9/11. Think the market meltdown of 2008. Think the BP gusher in the Gulf of Mexico. Each and all of them are what Nassim Taleb calls a black swan, with three things in common. A black swan is not predicted, not what you expect to see. It's heavy with effects, and then it's loaded up afterward with causes and explanations for what nobody saw coming. This is Open Source from the Watson Institute at Brown University. An American conversation with global attitude, we call it. This one is with the philosopher and historian who's also a market trader, Nassim Taleb. He's a writer, too, of a cult classic called The Black Swan. You're a man, Nassim Taleb, that all sorts of people, starting with finance types, want to learn from, although it's one of your main observations, if I read the book right, that what we human beings do not learn is that we do not learn.
Yes, the problem of our learning mechanism is that it's not made for the modern world. You're made to learn for an ancestral environment in which you're usually driven by the sensational, not by the statistically relevant. And in that world, was a beautiful world for us because everything lined up. We didn't develop any biases, and what we learned was relevant. Today, what we need to learn is more complicated, second-order effects, and we don't. We just learn, for example, if you have stock market crashes, that you need to predict the next one instead of telling yourself that the stock market is fragile. The modern world has much more complicated set of causes and explanations. If a truck goes on a bridge and the bridge breaks, it's a problem related to the bridge, not related to the truck. But our intuition is made to blame it on the truck.
Interesting. We'll come back to this matter of what's wrong with us or what's wrong with the modern world. But would you just leap right into the BP crisis? I mean, what is that, a black swan?
Well, I mean, for BP, yes. And let me tell you what my point in the black swan is, that you cannot predict events, but you know where you have fragility. Hmm. And effectively, modern corporations are driven to their maximum fragility by stock analysts, because they're going to save costs on insurance, save costs on having layers of safety, of security, and things like that. And that was manifest recently in the last few months in two events, Toyota and BP. And that comes from not being paranoid enough in areas in which you need to be paranoid, and not spending enough money for protection, for redundancy, for safety nets and things like that. And that neglect is usually common with very large corporations or corporations listed in the stock market, and much less common with family-owned businesses. Hmm. So my general concept is, what is fragile and what is not? And that's my general framework. And I've added to the black swan that section, 80 pages, is called On Robustness and Fragility, where I go deeper into the point that Mother Nature is robust, that large corporations are fragile, that large corporations even more fragilized by the fact that their size makes them more vulnerable to shocks. So not only the stock markets make you save on insurance, but at the same time, your size makes you more vulnerable to shocks. There are two lessons from BP. The one, of course, about size I just mentioned, that large corporations aren't better than small corporations. They seem to be saving money, but in fact, they're more vulnerable. And the second one concerns the structure of our environment. I make a comparison between two earthquakes that happened in Japan, one that took place in Tokyo in 1920s, and one that took place in Kobe, not far, in 1994, I think. What we learned from these events is that with time, the economic and social consequences of physical catastrophes have increased and are increasing. Nature hurts us much more economically because of web of interaction. The BP and the volcano that we just observed recently, and these things, because either corporations are larger or because we have more interaction, we are suffering a greater impact from black swans today.
Part of the whole black swan phenomenon is the backward look at it, the hindsight understanding, which is, as you point out, it's largely fabricated. What does hindsight tell you, for example, about BP? I mean, people are calling it, you know, a corporate mistake. They're trying now to blame it on Barack Obama. But, I mean, what is this business of a retroactive understanding?
The problem with humans is that we're much better at seeing history running backwards than history running forward. And we always have this feeling of having been able to understand the past because we run it, you know, in a reverse motion. After an event happens, you have a lot of fingers pointed and a lot of explanation what was wrong. To me, what is wrong and what was wrong in both this and the economic crisis 2008 and other crises as well is the fragility, not the fact that there was a mistake. We humans are error prone, and we cannot stop being error prone. And it's part of being human, and it's actually part of the charm of being a human, that tendency to make mistakes. What you need to do is reduce the sensitivity to these mistakes, have a more of a systematic approach to reduce sensitivity to these mistakes. And that was my problem. So maybe you should blame it mainly on BP's size and the fact that it has to comply with the stock market, the fact that it's not family-owned, the fact that managers have, just like bankers, different incentives than owners, and the fact that society also is not really their responsibility. So we have that's a real problem, not the supervision of an actual project or something like that.
I'm glad you mentioned the economic crisis, and it's not over, because
it hasn't started yet, in my opinion.
Interesting. Because we're all looking for some larger understanding now, you know, as a crisis of capitalism, something in the history of economic activity. What kind of a black swan was this ongoing crisis? And you say it's going to get worse.
Well, in the black swan, I said that I pointed at the fragility in the system, in the financial system and the economic system, coming from two facts. The first one is a rise of unpredictability in the world coming from the web, the networks, the interactions, globalization, a rise of efficiency. All that causes a degradation of predictability. Mm-hmm. The fact that the whole planet can react to the same fad causes winner-take-all effects. You don't know which company is going to win, but he who's going to win will win big. So you've had that accelerating since the digital revolution, that rise of unpredictability. And of course, the web made things go much faster. In an environment like that, mistakes can be costlier, because when you make a mistake, it can cost you a lot more. Because things can move in the opposite direction with much more severity than before. So number one, we had a rise of unpredictability. Number two, we had the exact opposite, a rise in hidden risks in the form of debt. The debt levels we have in the Western world today are monstrous, about five times in relation to economic activity what we had in the 1970s. So we had not only a rise of unpredictability, but it was coupled with a rise of mistakes prone, you see, structures like complex derivatives and the rise of debt. So you know that unpredictability and debt are not friends. Because if you make a mistake and you have debt, you still have to repay the money. If you're right, things are okay if you have debt. So the system was just like an accident waiting to happen. And of course, the accident started happening in 2008. Now, what's making things worse today is that government stepped in and, in a way, fragilized the system even further by transforming that huge level of debt is being progressively transformed from private, in other words, between corporations and individuals, or individuals and other individuals, transforming it from private into public. And once debt becomes public, it's irreversible and doesn't disappear. The problem with governments is that the government cannot go bankrupt. So what Obama's team's doing is transforming liabilities between private individuals who made mistakes, or even in some cases it was beyond making a mistake, it was were successful at what they wanted to do. They take advantage of the system. So you had individuals who got us here, now getting out scot-free, and our great-great-grandchildren will have to pay the price. That's what worries me. So when I say the crisis has not started, it's because when I look at the future, I realize that we are relying more and more on forecasts, on forecast errors in the system, whereas in the past, people could make forecast error, it wouldn't have any consequence. Today, it will have massive consequences because the forecast errors can lead to like a tripling of future government deficits. That's a severe problem. So we are much more dependent on expert mistakes than we did in the past. And one thing I showed in A Black Swan is that these experts were good at explaining backwards things, but not good at predicting that the collective community of economists worldwide did not predict this crisis. So you can't trust them to see what's going on in the future.
You said that nature is robust and human institutions are fragile. I mean, this makes sense to me that bankruptcy at the corporate level is a kind of natural defense against ups and downs of the economy. But once it becomes government debt, it's permanent. It's forever. I should have said getting into the economic crisis that I started reading you on the advice of macroeconomists who said the one guy that understands the real nature here of what's going on is not the macro guys, and it's not the people who talk about a perfect storm or a failure of regulation. It's Nassim Taleb with the theory of fragility.
No, it is. I mean, the problem was very simple for me. First of all, when you see a problem happen and you can visualize a solution to the problem rather quickly. And my view of things was as follows. When the crisis happened in 2008, I begged anybody who would listen to me. Mm-hmm. And actually, I got once furious in Washington and I walked down a delegation to the White House to kiss Larry Summers' ring, you know. A bunch of people. I just walked out because they weren't getting the point. For me, the problem was not a problem of trying to get out of a recession. My problem was a problem of debt that needed to be cured immediately because there was a cancer and that cancer was spreading. You see? And also, it was a problem of methodology that needed to be changed, not a transitory problem like the swings in the economy that we've had in the past, 100 years, okay, outside the Great Depression. So that was my problem. And the solution to that problem, the solution to cancer is not painkillers. The solution to cancer is surgery or whatever, something drastic to remove the tumor.
Does that make you a deficit hawk? Does that make you an anti-Keynesian?
Well, number one, I don't like Keynesian and anti-Keynesian because I know Keynes' work rather well, and Keynes was someone who understood uncertainty extremely well, and he understood the environment, and he would agree with me because, number one, when Keynes did his theories, the unpredictability of systems was not there, or he wasn't aware of such unpredictability, and the systems were not as interconnected, and you did not start off of reliance on government mistakes as much as we did in the past. So things were cleaner, easier, and a stimulus that would have worked, you know, in a Great Depression cannot work today because the environment is markedly different. My analogy is to a gambler who lost a lot of money and now is gambling with the trust fund of his great-great unborn grandchildren. To me, there's a morality to it that's not there. But let me go back to what my solution was that when you have a mistake done between adults, someone needs to pay the price, and I'd rather pay the price now than have to pay it later, you see, by cleaning up the system and making sure that the cause, which is a high level of debt, the cause of the problem is removed, okay? And start working on it immediately. What it looks like, they put Novocaine, which meaning it's exactly the same thing they did in 1982, 83. So the longer you wait, the worse it's going to be. And that was my point. So we should have started doing something a little more sensible at the time. And also, we should not have gotten people in charge who did not see the crisis coming. You see, someone who did not understand the concept of fragility to extreme events and fragility of systems to black swan should not be put in charge, namely Bernanke and the other people. So Obama kept getting very bad advice for all this time. Now today, look what's happening. Governments in Europe are starting to realize the core cause of the problem is debt. And they're starting austerity measures today in the face of a crisis with much lower number of people employed today than we had 2 years ago.
But this is precisely the austerity that you know, a lot of people's hero, mine most of the time, Paul Krugman, says is wrong.
Well, number one, Paul Krugman doesn't understand extreme events. I'm sorry. I know from his mathematics that his mathematics are archaic mathematics made for a different environment than socioeconomic environment. If you perturbate all these models these people use, and I've mentioned that in the second edition of the Black Swan, a lot of these theories go out the window. Paul Krugman doesn't understand that in the event of Paul Krugman being wrong, the costs are going to be monstrous. And I worry on the cost of being wrong. And odds are they're going to be wrong because these projections have never been right in the past. So nothing ensures me that they're going to be right in the future. It's like someone who wakes you up at night to try to borrow $1,000 from you because he has a sure thing trade in the morning. Okay, that's the kind of Paul Krugman trade. It doesn't work that way. Prudence should be the first thing on the agenda of governments, not speculation. And to me, these stimulus packages are speculation. It would have been nice if we started off, okay, with a surplus. You see, the problem with governments is that because of the electoral system, they encouraged to have deficits all the time. They always shoot for surplus, by the way, but they end up with deficit and say, oh, we'll be taken care of. Like France has promised to have a surplus and have had deficits for 39 years. So the problem with running stimulus in the face of deficits is that you need to get that money sometimes, somewhere, from someone. And you're starting to resemble Madoff, you see. There is something I call distance from Madoff. You know Madoff, the gentleman who had a poor Ponzi scheme, and you always need a bigger guy to borrow from to repay the previous guy. So it's a Ponzi scheme usually fails because you need to borrow more and more to satisfy past obligations. And we're going to get into that situation unless we have a massive recovery. So you're gambling on a massive recovery. For me, it's too big a gamble, and it's also immoral. And there's another thing here. All these projections we have from Office and Management and Budget needs to be taken with a grain of salt because their past projections have always been very bad. So let me summarize. What I'm saying is not particularly intelligent nor new. The Babylonians know it. They had debt jubilees. The Babylonians understood the value of that debt is something that makes systems collapse. And of course, if you take ancient Mediterranean culture, they also relearned that. There are a lot of expressions, at least 17 expressions in Latin or Greek, shaming debt. And of course, the Septuagint that doesn't like debt, and Islam bans lending with interest.
Shakespeare didn't like it either.
Neither. Yeah, of course. Neither borrowers nor lenders shall be, okay?
Right.
So, you see, Paul Krugman belongs to a school of thought. All these people who went to MIT and Harvard start and build models and take consequences off models. And my school of thought is the reverse. I take models and perturbate these models to see where models are wrong, because my expertise is in human error and in model error. But grandmothers after the Depression knew that. That they had, there was a rule of thumb, supposedly, after the Great Depression, that a grandmother would tell her grandson, have 2-3 years of salary saved somewhere before you take any personal risk. Well, I want that to apply to governments as well.
Nassim Taleb, stand back from this economic crisis, even from BP, even from 9/11. What do these black swans have in common, really? And I also want to know, have we entered the age of the black swan? They seem to be cropping up every day now.
Well, the black swan is usually you don't see it coming, and it's very consequential. Like, for example, in the book business, the black swan are in form of bestsellers, and between 5 and 20 novels sometimes represent the bulk of the sales of novels in the English language. So you realize these exceptions matter enormously. So what they have in common, the black swan, is, well, two things. Number one, the black swan to me is a surprise. It's not a surprise, 9/11 was not a surprise for the terrorist involved, but it was a surprise for the person in the towers. So that's the first thing they have in common, that there's somewhere a turkey involved. A turkey is someone who doesn't know that you're facing something more unpredictable than he thinks.
I love that image. Yes. In the book. You say for the turkey, history makes a lot of sense. It just proceeds from day to day. He gets fatter and fatter, and then bang, it's Thanksgiving, and it's over. He didn't see it coming, but the butcher did.
Exactly. So that's the first thing about the black swan. There's a turkey involved in a black swan. Okay. And the second thing about the black swan is that it is an event that makes a lot of sense after the fact. Mm-hmm. Like if you take Bernanke, now he seems to understand why the crisis happened. But as the risks were mounting in the system, he called it the Great Moderation, and people were arguing with me about my political and economic and social views by saying Mr. Bernanke has declared that the world has entered Great Moderation, so we don't have to worry about your black swan anymore. Finish is something of the past, you see. So the very same Bernanke now is explaining the crisis backwards and understand why it happens. So this feeling, the fact that you understand things after they happen, makes you think deep down that you can predict them. So that's the second big thing of the black swan, that Turkey, after the fact, will not know that it was a turkey, or will think it was less of a turkey than it actually was.
It struck me as I read your book that love, as we think about it, certainly as people sing about it, is a black swan. It's always a surprise. Zing went the strings of my heart, never expected it, blah, blah, blah. And then it turns into, you know, that song, It Had to Be You. It was all inevitable. That's a good black swan, I suppose.
But yeah, probably. Yeah, it's a good black swan meeting a spouse. And I don't know whether if the person is really a match or whether Mother Nature convinces you that you're made for each other and you have no alternative, both of you. So there is something like that. It's, to me, in my new writing, I say that love is a victory of the particular over the universal.
Have we not entered a sort of terrific breeding ground of black swans, these horrific surprises that take the globe all at once overnight? And I have a theory, but I wonder what your theory is as to why they seem to be more and more characteristic of the age, of the 21st century phenomenon.
We can say safely that the black swan started entering society with agriculture, with the fact that we started settling, with the fact that with complexification started then. In my tableau, what's fragile and what's robust, the nation-state is not robust. The nation-state is a fragile entity, whereas city-state are more robust and actually have survived much longer than nation-states. So the creation of the nation-state created this big, unpredictable event that the First War, even those who saw it coming, didn't see the damage it was about to cause. So the First War probably is the most consequential one, and it came in two volumes. The second volume was Hitler, of course. In totality, it killed between 50 and, say, 90 million people. Depends who's counting, you see. So that was a big black swan. So we had a rise, but I think that today we're entering a different world of black swan because of the internet. And let me explain. The whole planet reads the same book. So if you have a bestseller, Harry Potter, almost every child on the planet is capable of reading that book, you see? So the ratio, you can either measure, you can measure it very easily. I tried with the ratio of income of opera singers, the top to the average. In the past, it was not that big, you know? Of course, a successful opera singer would do better than a mediocre one, but the mediocre one would always have his audience, and the successful one can't really store his voice and scale it, you see? That's what we call scaling. Whereas they invented that gramophone and then later on all these other video things. And a successful opera singer would be heard across the planet, and the unsuccessful one would have to work for Barnes & Noble, you see? So that ratio of the superstar to the average is one manifestation of rise of black swans. And you can see it in almost every field. Take the sports arena, take any field shows that characteristic. Take businesses, look at how much Google represents of world, the internet, compared to other companies. And also you have to take into account companies that die every day, you see. So you have that, but that the same applies to problems as well. Like how much a single mistake will cost the world today compared to what it would have cost in the past. So both opportunities and, of course, disasters are being concentrated. But we can do a lot about it. In my new essay, there's something I call the fourth quadrant. Because to me, I don't really care about predicting black swans. I don't really care about black swans if they're inconsequential. But if they're of massive consequence and I'm very exposed to them, then I have to worry. So I have a tableau of things that are of big consequence and things we are exposed to. And the one that worries me the most now is in a biological domain, not the economic domain.
Hmm. Well, could I just note in passing, though, that you're talking about scalability on a sort of digital infinite possibility. Bill Gates could never be 2 or 3 times taller than you or me, but he can be a billion times richer, certainly than me. It's the sort of the nuclear weapon multiplication of the power of things, of celebrity, of the speed of digital networks. It's the dark side of the network world, it seems to me, is what you're driving at.
But are these networks inherently fragile? Do they have black swans built into them?
Yes. What happens with networks is that they seem to be more stable, but once in a while, if a big node is hit, then the system collapses. And the entire system collapses in an unpredictable way and often in not very easy to see ahead of time. So these network things create fragility, especially when you have a lot of, not a single network like the internet, but when you talk about supplies and chains and very complicated commercial activities that depend on each other or money flowing from businesses and profit lines and all that, it becomes, you have superposed networks that are very complicated to understand. So if I wanted to buy shoes at Bloomingdale's, I order them, then I cancel my order, and then they reduce their order, and it hits some tipping point, and they cancel an order, big order from China, okay?
Mm.
The Chinese factory closes down. You're going to have fewer, less demand, Chinese demand for French wine, and the French vineyard will have a bad year, leading to, I don't know, fewer Frenchmen in buying Apple computers. So the thing with percolates through the system with immense speed. And you don't know where those nodes are. With electricity grids, you can see how nodes, vulnerable nodes, how they are built and where they are located. With the forests, you know, to see how forest fires are really take place, you can probably see that. But in economic life, we don't know because we have a lot of superposed complicated networks.
Can I ask, what are the media implications of all this? I mean, when Fox News can hold an enormous audience that people dreamed of in the past, but in all those local institutions, particularly newspapers, symbolically, and the idea of local opinion is fading out.
I'm against the news. I'm not against the media. I'm against supplying people with news about the environment because it's very unnatural and causes collective consciousness to be divorced from one's local one.
You say newspapers make us stupid, and I'm not quite clear why.
Because they always give you an explanation to events, so you have the feeling that you understand what's going on. They tell you stock market went down because of fear of the recession, and that false causation that insert in there. I mean, they check their facts, but you can't check the causes. So you have a feeling of overcausation from newspapers. That's number one, the first one. The second one, because newspapers aren't going to tell you we had 280 deaths on the roads today in America. They're going to tell you about a plane crash killing 14 people. So you have misrepresentation of a map of risks. They are driven by the sensational. And the statistical and the sensational are not the same in our modern world. There's a third thing about newspapers is that supplying someone with news reduces his understanding of the world. It's more complicated to go into here, but let me tell you how I cope with it. I don't mind knowing the news, but I go by social filter. I eat lunch and dinner with other people. I try to. Okay, I still have people who still want to eat lunch or dinner with me. I'm lucky.
Sure.
Even after writing The Black Swan. And I make sure, you eavesdrop on conversation or something like that. I can tell if something's going on.
Yes.
If there's an event of significance, I know about it. And then I go to the web or go buy a paper sometimes or something like that.
Or go to Facebook and get the real news. Yeah, go ahead.
I don't know. Facebook I don't like for some reason.
Well, but it does serve as a kind of newspaper, a gossip place. You'll hear about a great movie or a great book or a great basketball
on Facebook,
game. Yeah.
Maybe. I don't like these social things on Facebook because anything that draws me away from face-to-face contact with people is harmful to my health.
Okay.
I truly believe in nature. And I try not to spend too much time on a web except to set up an appointment with someone, to contact my publisher, to complain, to my banker, things like that, or to run the businesses I'm in. Because I think that the internet can take life on its own and does make people happy. I'm happier living a life that's closer to my gene, my genetic background, and what makes me happy. What makes me so to me, socializing on Facebook is the equivalent of eating meals they used to watch in science fiction movies. You know, these meals that would make airplane food look like a 3-star Michelin.
All right. Go from newspapers and that kind of punditry to history itself. You're probably not high on this idea or the cliche that those who cannot remember the past are condemned to repeat it, because you would say remembering the past is not, in fact, what we do with it. We remake it. But
yeah, exactly.
What about history?
Well, I am in favor of erudition, of knowledge of a lot of historical events. I am in favor of that. Because when you have a lot of facts, then it reduces the number of theories you have in your head. And because then if you know a lot, then you realize how little a theory can explain. And usually people who know little have more theories. So I'm in favor of erudition, historical erudition. I'm in love with history. I mean, I know a lot of history for a non-historian. So I like, but there are some biases in the way history comes to us, and history is a narrative, and it's a backwards narrative based on some data points and facts, and of course it's going to be false, and people will think it's true. So that's the first problem with history. The second one is what I call over-deterministic view of the world coming from history, because you have the feeling that history ran this way because it was bound to happen that way. So we call teleological or the Whig interpretation of history. Like history is supposed to run its course, that it's unavoidable that it would have had this thing happen. When the history doesn't offer you counterfactual, what I call it counterfactual, different scenarios, different things could have happened. So this is learning too narrowly from history. And let me explain it again with the same metaphor I use today to explain complex system. A naive historian, reading a naive historian, or a newspaper, okay, it says it will give you the same result. I have a bridge collapsing because visibly it was not well built. Most newspaper and historian would focus on the last car that was on it before it collapsed. And that's what I call the anecdote versus a more structural view of things. When you analyze complex system, you got to analyze things in terms of robustness, fragility, general attributes. And this we've known since Aristotle with his ideas of near cause, approximate, and remote cause, and ultimate. So the historians tend to give you a lot of cause, and it's much better to just take history to understand the facts and learn as much from these facts, because there's a lot of wisdom in them. But at the same time, try to avoid the over-reliance on theories and narratives. So try to avoid theoretical history and try to have, even if you have anecdotes, series of anecdotes, not too much theories built into them. And that's my problem with newspapers, is that every day a newspaper offers you series. Why a guy lost a race? Why this? Why that? Why this guy this? Why? Even in sports, they always have these explanations, because we humans are hungry for explanations. And that hunger for explanation is what makes us misrepresent the world, because there's a higher content of randomness in them.
Did you answer my question whether we've entered the age of the black swan and more of these events?
Yeah, when I said enter the age of scalability automatically implies the age of more positive or more negative black swans. And, of course, we have an age of fragility. Now, where is the fragility at its max, of course, in economic life? Where am I worried the most? In biological life. And let me explain. There is something called the island effect in biology, which is the number of species you will find per square meter is vastly higher in an island than on continent.
Yes.
And in cultural life, we had that in cultural life, and we've had that in biological life. Now, this entire thing is out the window. So the cultural life doesn't have the island protection anymore. And the whole planet reads the same books, plus or minus some variations. But now, what I'm worried about is that there's no place to hide from the next big antibiotic-resistant disease that will fly on British Air or even on Air France. You know, the food is better on Air France, I think.
Explain how that works.
Well, I mean, think about it. In the past, the Great Plague you had some areas that were remote and not connected to other areas that were spared. Today, the whole planet would have that great plague. And it will travel faster than it did on horseback. It will travel on airplanes.
Scary.
And we are more vulnerable today, and I guarantee you we're more vulnerable. Now, I mean, in the book, I'm very interested in robustness at a personal level. We're much more vulnerable than our ancestors because we've had all these antibiotics that make us, that mollify us, the word I use, mollify us. We have air conditioning, so we don't have enough thermal stress. We don't have enough hunger. Personal hunger, if you go through episodes of hunger. So we don't have these stressors that usually make you a little more resistant to these diseases. So we are weaker. We are not in as good shape. We live longer, but we're not in great shape. And we are more exposed to that big one biologically.
This is related to the general fear of monocultures, whether it's in potatoes or corn.
That's exactly
corn.
The potato, exactly. The potato started it all. You know, because think about it, the scalability of humans start to play with plants versus nature. Like big corporations, we focus on one crop and the whole world has the same crop.
Right.
In 2005 was a year where I flew around the world giving lectures, academic lectures around the black swan. And I went in France, in Asia, in South Africa, everywhere. Wherever I went, there was the same apple in the reception of the hotel.
Yeah.
Okay. That same apple.
Right.
Okay. So I was shocked. There's the whole world is eating the same a couple of apples, where the diversity in apples was huge. And of course, you know, the potato famine we may have something of the scale of potato famine, you see.
That's what led to the famine, right?
Exactly. They had their own ecosystem was very diversified. And then they suddenly focused on one crop, the potato in Ireland, where England didn't have the same. England was much more diverse, and England didn't suffer at all during that period.
So the question comes, what's to be done about these black swans? You remind me, somebody has rewritten the famous E.M. Forster line, only connect. The answer today is going to be only disconnect, which is going to be hard to do. But I'm just thinking of the other responses, including to BP or the economic crisis. It's borrow, or it's re-regulate, or it's change parties, or complain.
Well, I mean, the what is fragile, of course, one crop is fragile. One large country is fragile versus a lot of city-states. We see that in Arabia, in UAE. You know, Dubai is in trouble, but its sister state is not in trouble. So you have more, the city-states is more diversity. So the idea is more diversity. In the face of this global integration, you have to make sure nothing is big. And that's my theory. I explain in the Black Swan, and I've shown in a scientific paper. Look in nature. Nature is very connected. But the biggest thing you see on land is the elephant. If you shot an elephant, it wouldn't have a big impact. But if an elephant makes a mistake, who cares? It's not going to, you know, it dies. It doesn't impact the ecosystem. But if Goldman Sachs has a problem tomorrow, the whole financial and economic infrastructure collapses. So what we have to address these points, and what socialist governments have done, I mean, I don't know if regulation, because the regulators are causing us to be black swan prone because more top down, and they fortify companies that get weak and big. I like what the UK, both parties, the Liberal and the Conservatives, okay, so the union is interesting because both of them want to protect the small guy. And you don't protect the small guy by giving the small guy money. You know how you protect the small guy? By not protecting the big guy.
Interesting.
By not protecting the large corporations, you're helping the small person. I'm sure that by not protecting Detroit in 1980, we hurt a lot of people who wanted to get in that business.
How do you confront the first impulse, which is to securitize our defenses, to build up the Pentagon budget, or let the government take over the BP repairs, for example?
I mean, I'm not in the business now of what I call ambulance. I'm not an ambulance driver or emergency room. So an emergency room reaction is not the long-term one. The long-term thing is prevention of these, that any catastrophe or any error could be a large scale. That accidents can happen and remain confined. That's my concept of robustness, that companies go bankrupt and don't drag other things. And incidentally, let me tell you, where things are the least regulated and with the smallest government intervention is where things are the most robust. Take the food business, the restaurant business.
Mm.
You know the restaurant business? It's wonderful. And they're born and die every day in New York. And those that survive make it for a long time, build a reputation, and of course they try to get bigger, and of course, and then they make a mistake, and some food critic complains, and thing collapses. That's where we're going. The system can clean itself up for all industries to be along that model. That you can be, of course, larger than a restaurant, but your restaurant natural unit is confined by time and place. But this is where we're heading.
What do you mean we're heading? Inevitably or in policy?
Inevitably, because I think that no matter, no government is big enough to fortify a business or a company or anything that is fragile. No government is large enough. All government can do is delay and make things more painful later. So, what is the solution? Okay, I think the solution is for society to understand fragility and start acting personally and collectively on that. Like, for example, if security analysts understood the concept of fragility, a lot of companies that are the darling of security analysts today would not be in existence.
Hmm.
You see, because they encourage companies to become fragile by shooting for bottom line at the expense of lack of risk control, because it's expensive to be overinsured. Mother Nature likes overinsurance. Mother Nature likes you to have two lungs. So Mother Nature likes you to have spare parts, and an economist would say it's inefficient. So we have to change your thinking. Once you change your thinking, you understand that you have two enemies. Number one is lack of redundancy, and surplus is redundancy. You have cash on the side. So it makes you less vulnerable to black swans. And the second one, nothing too big. In the presence of interdependence, nothing should be too big. So what governments should do is disincentive for size. And I think the UK people understand that rather well.
So you would be for breaking up the banks, no more bailouts, no too big to fail.
Yeah, no, I would take the banks as a no-brainer. Okay, of course, if you stop the moral hazard, you don't even have to break up the bank. Let them collapse, because look what's going to happen. And then naturally the units that are healthy would experience a rebirth. But banks would disappear by themselves if you lower the debt in society, because they depend on debt. They're like leeches. And banks grow and make debt grow with them. So the enemy we have is debt, and the enemy is caused by banks.
Nassim Taleb, I'm fascinated by all of this, but I'm listening for the big themes. The big themes are, in fact, what your grandmother would have told you. I mean, this is old-fashioned morality for face-to-face living, not on the web. You're talking about prudence, an old virtue. You're talking about a kind of intergenerational morality. Don't leave your grandchildren with your mistakes. Is there more we should say about the big picture here, or does that kind of begin to wrap it?
Well, you have to apply these concepts vastly more forcibly in what I call the fourth quadrant, areas that are black swan prone.
Do you want to give us the big four so that we won't forget them?
The four quadrants, okay. The four quadrants, they're two environments. One environment I call Mediocristan. In like your weight cannot exceed 500 pounds, maybe 600 pounds, no more. Mediocristan. And the other one I call Extremistan. It's an environment in which variables, can take any value. Okay, and that's a scalable thing. That's where the sky is a limit. That's a Bill Gates phenomenon. Bill Gates cannot be heavier than 500 pounds, but he can be a billionaire, a trillionaire if he wants, without suffering from it, okay? So there's sort of two environments, one in which the black swan, when it hits, is insignificant. The other one, it's consequential, all right? And then I have two kind of exposures to black swan. One in which I'm rather robust to the black swan, and a second one in which a black swan will affect me enormously, what I call the exposure, simple versus complex exposure, Mediocristan, Extremistan. And the quadrant that I worry about is the quadrant in which you have a complex exposure, to Extremistan. In other words, you're extremely exposed to the black swan. That's the one we have to worry about, and in which you have to build robustness. Once you make that map, you realize that we need to act very quickly.
This is hugely stimulating, and we're going to talk with you again, I hope. We'll read anything you write, and we thank you for a truly inventive, different, out-of-the-box slant on an incredibly complex moment. Nassim Nicholas Taleb, thank you.
Thank you for inviting me.
Paul McCarthy and Ben Mandelkern produced and edited this conversation. It isn't over till listeners add their two bits in comments on our website, radioopensource.org. I'm Christopher Leiden. Thank you for being part of the conversation.